Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The 6th annual Milwaukee Film Festival announces Black Lens, which features work from both emerging and established African-American filmmakers. There are 8 fiction and documentary films, and I had a chance to see one of them and hope to see more during the run of the film festival. The goal is directly to spotlight African-American filmmakers, and it's not just films with Black-related subject matter, but also the creative individuals behind the films. There are many films that we'll be talking about this hour, and later in the hour, we'll speak with one of the documentary filmmakers who did this really absorbing, and you know, it was one of those films you saw and you realized the importance of film in teaching you something new, because it looked at the history of the photograph and how it has been used to both demean and uplift African Americans. It looked at the African American family through photograph, and some of the history, of course, is horrendous lynchings, the photos that were taken of lynchings. Others are just really beautiful, particularly the time right after Reconstruction, when the African American family was fashioning what it would be in the American landscape. So we're going to talk about all of this hour of the program, and we're delighted to do so. I know many of you are going to the film festival over the course of its run. Gerard Blanks is our guest in studio the first part of the hour. He is co-programmer of Black Lens. He's also a domestic violence victims advocate for Sojourner Family Peace Center. He's a music promoter and a former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel contributor. And we thank you so much, Gerard, for being in our studios today. And this is an exciting venture, all of these films. I just love documentary films, I must say. There's just, you learn so much from them, and it stays in your mind, and it's a wonderful endeavor.
It's the best way to learn. I mean, the best way, it's how I learn. You know, I have to be honest, I am a painfully slow reader. I was one of those guys when they assigned readings in class, I went and tried to see if there was a documentary, you know, because that's how I learned. And a lot of it comes from my mother. I mean, I fancied myself growing up. I thought I was going to be a director. And I still may be.
Yeah, so, I was going to say,
at some
you're
point,
a young guy.
I'm more on the writing part of it now. But I just love film, and film has taught me so much. And it's how I expanded my vocabulary. I'd watch films, and I would hear how actors would use certain words in certain contexts. In a certain context, I remember I actually learned what the word context meant from The Cosby Show. So that's, film has just been such a part of my upbringing and my education.
Let's talk about some of the films you're going to be presenting. And one I have read, film that spoke directly to you, I'm sure all of them do, but this 25 to Life film you found particularly gripping.
Yeah. There have been a lot of documentaries about AIDS and HIV. There haven't been a lot dealing with the effect on the Black community. And not just the effect in terms of the just unbelievable amount of Black people that are dying from this disease, but the cultural implications of the disease. And what this film does is it deals with AIDS and HIV in a way that I've never seen. It follows William Bronner and his journey as a young kid who, I don't want to give it all away because some of the surprise it's a part of what makes the film great, but basically he's a young man growing up with HIV since he was very young, and he had, in his relationships with women, is a big part of the film, and how he reaches out to these women and tells them, hey, I have HIV and you might want to get checked. You know, that's powerful. That's amazing.
Sure,
what I've been telling people is, look, you're going to feel some kind of way when you leave, whether you feel like, God, this guy is heroic and he really, you know, is inspiring for the work he's doing now, or I can't believe this guy did what he did and I don't care. There's no way I can respect him. It's amazing. You're going to be blown away. I can't wait to meet him because he's going to be here for the film.
Oh, you'll meet him for the first time.
Great. I'm meeting everybody. We brought in directors, producers, and actors for all the films.
Exciting. Tell me about Black Lens. Why was it important to make this a part of the film festival?
The film festival, in And this is the sixth year, but in the 5 years prior, has progressed at such an amazing rate. And I just felt like when they pitched it to me and said, hey, you want to be a part of this? I'm like, who wouldn't want to be a part of this, right? But the way they pitched it to me was that it was just time. Last year, they brought in George Tillman, who's a native of Milwaukee, to premiere one of his new films. 1,000 people showed up for that screening, right? And there was such support from the Black community that Jonathan Jackson, the executive director, said, we have something here, right? We need to find a way to outreach to the Black community, to tap into this community who wants to be a part. But, you know, with the Black community, let's in Milwaukee and in any American city, we want to be a part of the arts community. We want to be a part of the culture in our city, but sure. We also want to feel welcome. Mm-hmm. And what Black Lens does, it says to people, you're not only welcome, we not only want you to come, but we want to cater to your taste. And the whole idea of Black Lens is to get people in the door, and they're going to find hundreds, literally hundreds of films other than these that they're going to be interested in watching. But it's just time. It's time for this sort of thing in Milwaukee.
Do you think, I was, as I told you, and we'll speak with the director of the film about Black photography later on this hour, but I was really struck watching that documentary last night by how photography for African Americans was just something that was big name photographers. It was very, very hard field to enter, and there just weren't very many, particularly mm-hmm. years ago, and women photographers who were Black, forget it. Is that also true of filmmaking and documentary filmmaking, or are there more African Americans in that field?
There are certainly more. I mean, filmmakers are generally more high profile than photographers, so you're going to know more Black filmmakers, but you'd be surprised. For instance, when we were doing research and bringing in the 100 films that we just wanted to consider, I was checking out what other film festivals were doing. Because frankly, we wanted to see, okay, you know, what are the films that people are talking about around the country, right? And we would pick these films only to realize they had an all-Black cast. It was about a Black subject matter, but the director wasn't Black. Or the producers. And It was funny because we had this database, and I would see films be deleted, and I'd say, why aren't we considered? That's a great film. The director's not Black. The producers aren't Black. And I started to realize there are a lot of Black films or films about Black subject matters with predominantly Black casts, but there aren't a lot of Black, not just directors, directors of photography, producers, executive producers. So that's what I think really makes this special, is that we're saying let's pay attention to the creators, right? Because when you're talking about photographers and when you're talking about filmmakers, these are the people that shape our imagination in a way, right? And if you're a young Black kid and you don't see anyone that looks like you, or if you're a young woman, right, and you don't see any female photographers or filmmakers, the idea of you being one right. doesn't seem right. as credible, as valid. So that's what's so exciting about this. Sometimes, you know, I have to temper my enthusiasm because I've had a penchant for running around and saying to people, you know, in 5 years we're going to be the premier showcase for Black filmmakers, and they're like, slow down, okay? let's just get through this year first. But I'm excited, and I want Milwaukee to be a place where filmmakers of any color, of any gender want to come, but especially young Black filmmakers want to come to Milwaukee because they're hearing about what's going on here.
Right. The other, and how true it is of the whole film festival and Black Lens as well, is how many films are being made out there that are so important for Americans to see, and they don't have widespread viewing because it's hard to get a documentary mm-hmm. as powerful as the one that you just said. That would be something everybody would be talking about if they could all see it. I guess some of them eventually make their way to television. I think I saw the Freedom Summer documentary mm-hmm. earlier on PBS, didn't I? Mm-hmm. This yep. summer, which was very good, and we'll talk about that. But they should be everywhere. All the time, they should be everywhere. We should be seeing these films.
Yeah, but if they were everywhere, people still wouldn't. I mean, what makes the film festival experience special is something that Jonathan Jackson, our executive director, constantly says. He talks about the communal experience of watching a film in a theater, mm-hmm. right? And so even something like Freedom Summer, which we knew had already been on PBS, some people had seen it. You know, when I would say to him, well, you know, this has already been out. You know, people may, he said, look, those films usually get the best turnout. People want to come together, sit in a theater with a bucket of popcorn they're probably not even going to eat, and just, you know, it's the fellowship, mm-hmm. you know, of being together in, with your community, even if you're watching a bad film, right? So I get what you're saying, that you feel like these should be out here. Everybody should have access to them. I think that's what makes the film festival experience special, because you can't see many of these films. Like, we have a documentary about a hip-hop group named Souls of Mischief. You're not going to find that anywhere, right?
Tell me about that one.
That one was sort of, there were a couple here I had to admit to the filmmakers, I almost missed this one. You know, I almost missed your film, I'm going to be honest. And this was one of those where it was like, I was a huge fan of the group growing up, right? And they have this album that I think is a classic album called 93 Till Infinity. And I didn't want to program a film based on my own personal. So there was it was weird because I was almost pushing against it because I felt like, if I program it, is it for me or is it for the audience, right?
Sometimes so, what's good for you is good for everybody.
Evidently,
right?
We had 140 people come, you know, right. 9 o'clock on a Friday night, or I'm sorry, on a Saturday night to come see this film. And it just felt so good because I was like, are people going to come? Are there enough people that love this group like I do? And I see 140 people come out, and I'm talking all races, shapes, sizes, ages, genders. I mean, it was just a beautiful crowd. But you're not going to see this anywhere else. And that's the thing. And that's why I think people came out, is because it's like, I didn't even know this film existed. I didn't know this film existed until I did research on the film festival. So that's what makes film festivals special. And there's a part of me that would love for these films to get wide distribution and everybody to be able to see them. And there's a part of me that's selfish that says, nah, you can only go see this at Black Lens.
Yeah, but you may want to see it twice.
Well, you know, my goal is to work hard and to really push this showcase to the point where we can have, you know, every film can maybe have three screenings. We only did one of Till Infinity, and I think that was a good move, just to do one to say, look, you have to come out on this night to come see it.
Right.
But yeah, I want to build it up where, yeah, we each film maybe has two or three screenings, and we'll have events attached to them, and, you know, just make this a fun time of year.
Mm-hmm. So do you have a choice of hundreds of films that you have to sift through before you pick which ones you'll show for Black Lens or what?
Yeah, it's not as daunting as it sounds. But, yeah, I mean, I remember we had a list of, like, maybe 30 or 40, and Jonathan said, fellas, myself and Dr. Dante McFadden, who's the other programmer, we need more films. I'm like, okay, so now we got 50. No, we need more films. So, yeah, you have to go through maybe 100 or so films. I mean, I actually looked at hundreds of films. Like, you know, looked at trailers, read summaries, read the bio of the filmmakers. You know, I researched the film festivals just to see, okay, what kind of film festival is this? Yeah, hundreds of films. Then you get down to maybe 100 films that you're considering, and then that 100 gets cut down, and then you have to figure out what films can you get screeners for, because you need to be able to watch the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a whole process that takes a really long time, and we really had to compress it. You know, we were up against the wall with this just because everything was moving so quickly, and reaching out to filmmakers and distributors and trying to get screenings and all that. It's a tough process, but it's rewarding because I got to see films that we weren't able to showcase that I had never even heard of before. And I'm like, wow, I didn't know there was a film. I'm a bit of a, I'm a hip hop head, right? But I love the art of sampling, taking old records and making them new hip hop beats, right? So there was a film called Hip Hop Fellow about a producer who's was teaching a course at Harvard on just that. So I'm up 2 o'clock in the morning. My wife is checking, like, Gerardo, are you coming to bed? It's like, no, I have to watch this again. This is so good. Because we'll be out at a restaurant and a song will come on and I'll be like, okay, I know that sample. That's Diana Ross. No, it's not Diana Ross. It's the Supremes. So-and-so sampled it for this song with Alicia Keys. She hates that, right? But this documentary, I got to just be a hip-hop nerd. Oh. Yeah, I loved it.
Oh. So you, some of these films, or maybe all of them, will have discussions because they're all worthy of great conversation.
Well, yeah. So in the program, you'll see these little, they're like little conversation bubbles that next to different showings. So if you grab a program, you can see which films have discussions. So like 25 Life has two discussions. At 3 o'clock today, I'm going to be at the Oriental to introduce Evolution of a Criminal, and that has a discussion. The director is going to be there. That his story is amazing. We were just at Shorewood High School the other day, and you know, just the kids were so. I'm always, you know, I've done a lot of stuff in schools, and so you get some, you know, some classrooms the kids couldn't care less. They were glued. I mean, like, it was just amazing to see the interaction they had with the director. As you,
they saw the film and then had the, or just,
well,
the director.
We showed two trailers.
I see.
And off of those two trailers, he was able to talk about the film for an hour, and the hands never came down. Just kids raising their hands. Mm. So get this. At the end of it, we're getting ready to leave, and the kids are like, they're trying to figure out if they can go to the particular screenings. And then the teacher's like, well, when it comes out on PBS, he was like, well, that's January. And the kids, like, all together were like, oh, January, that's too long. We can't wait. So he pulls out a DVD.
Oh,
right,
and says, bless his heart.
He looks at us and says, should I give it to him? And he says, well, you know what?
Oh.
I got something for you guys. And I mean, they cheered.
Oh,
it was,
what a story.
It was really funny. So the kids cheered and the teacher was so excited. And I'm like, this is a documentary film we're talking about, right? You're not supposed to be this happy, right? But they were so excited. So that is, man, that is a wonderful feeling.
And tell us more about that film. It's an interesting one. A 16-year-old and two friends robbing a suburban Houston bank. They're caught. They spend 3 years in prison. And then 15 years later, the young man returns home to heal the emotional scars. What a storyline.
Yeah. This was one of those films that before we came on the air, I was telling you how if a film's really good, I stop watching it.
You didn't see the end.
No, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I said, I have to. I want to be there. So, like, my wife is coming out to the 3 o'clock showing, and we're going to watch it together. I couldn't watch the end. It was so good. I was like, I have to see this in the theater and with everybody else. It's amazing. And he talked at Shorewood about the experience of going up to people and saying, not only saying, hey, I did this crime, the people that were affected by it, and I want to say I'm sorry. Not just that, but then having to say, and by the way, I'm doing a documentary on it. Do you want to be a part of it? And he was just talking about the process and how he had to be so careful, because some of these people he's approaching for the first time, they haven't seen this guy in like 18 years. They don't even know who he is. Remember, he was like 17 or
so. So he's the filmmaker.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. Yeah.
Oh, my.
Darius Clark Monroe he was sentenced to prison for 3 years, maximum security. He got his GED. He gets out. He gets in the film while he's in prison. He says, I want to go to film school. So he looks up film schools and he sees that NYU alums, Spike Lee, Martin Scorsese, says, I want to go to NYU. So I think he goes to Houston first, gets a degree, I believe, from Houston, then goes to NYU, becomes a filmmaker. Spike Lee, he won, I can't remember the name, but some prestigious award that Spike Lee hands out.
Wow.
And so he showed the film to Spike because Spike was talking to him about the title. And I told him that, too. When I first saw Evolution of a Criminal, I was like, I don't want to have a bunch of that in the Black Lens showcase, you know. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. then I watched it, and so I was talking to him, and he said, yeah, Spike Lee, he was telling the kids, Spike Lee had the same issue, but he explained it like the idea of evolving, right? He was looked at, he was seen as a criminal, right? You do 3 years of maximum security, people look at you as a criminal, and it's the evolution, mm-hmm. right? To the point where he's an accomplished filmmaker. Story's amazing. I can't do it justice. You got to go see the film.
I think you need to go and see the film after you see it the first time with the students at Shorewood.
That would
be interesting. And do a film about that. You could do a film about that, right? That'd be interesting.
Those kids are probably watching it right now. They're not going to. Yeah, but no, I want to reach out. I'm sorry. I want to reach out to the teacher just to see what their reaction
yes.
is.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. So what's going to move you into a career of making films? You're obviously really moved by them and have a creative sense about you, which is deep.
I'm working right now on several screenplays. That's part of my problem. Yeah, that's actually my biggest problem, is I can never just work on one, right? So I've been working on one for like 10 years, and right when I think I'm hitting a good stride and I'm almost there, I get another idea, and I got to go start on that one. So, you know, and then I have a lot of interest, and I just need to sit down. I need just a quiet space for a few weeks, nothing else, just finish my screenplay. Mm-hmm. You know, at least one of them. I got like five of them. So,
oh my goodness!
But I'm definitely going to get it done, and hopefully one day it will get made. But you know, I'm trying to figure it all out. I'm finishing school. I got a 3-year-old, you know. Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out how to balance the time, but I'm having a great time with the film festival and with my work with Sojourner Family Peace Center. So the screenplay will get done eventually.
Yeah, good for you. Do you want to give us? We have too many to talk about, but mm-hmm. give us one more film that's part of Black Lens description.
Hollywood Shuffle. Now I just want to tell you, Crew is going to be 7:45 tonight at the Oriental.
Which one?
Crew. That's the one. Okay. And we have Antoine Tanner, who's one of the stars. He's in town. We did a Q&A on Sunday. He's going to be in here. And we have the screenwriter, Oliver Ottley, is going to be in. They're going to be doing a Q&A afterwards. You don't want to miss that. That's going to be a great one. But Hollywood Shuffle, Robert Townsend is here. And Robert Townsend, like Hollywood Shuffle changed my life.
Really?
Oh, I mean, I'd never seen anything. And people don't realize Hollywood Shuffle predates Do the Right Thing. Robert Townsend predates Spike Lee. I mean, in terms of, you're talking about a monumental, a paradigm shifting movie. This was, it was a satire of the movie industry's depiction and treatment of African American actors and filmmakers and just African Americans in 1987. This film would be revolutionary today, but in 1987, Robert Townsend for me is, I just feel like he doesn't get enough credit. And we were sitting around a table, because originally we were looking at that Do the Right Thing, because it's, I think, the 25th anniversary.
Really?
Yeah, 25th anniversary. But that didn't work out. And so we were like, well, what else should we do? And somebody threw out Hollywood Shuffle. Actually, Dante McFadden threw out Hollywood Shuffle. And so I think I said to Jonathan, what about Robert Townsend? And he says, let's call. I think like 2 days later, I get an email. We got him. I'm like, oh. Yeah, it's so, you know, 1987, I was 9 years old. And to think I'm watching that film for the 20th time and now I get to meet the man.
Right.
That's, you know, that's the beautiful thing about doing this work, is meeting someone like Robert Townsend, watching Hollywood Shuffle with a bunch of people my age that remember what it was like when it came out. You can't beat that.
Doesn't get much better than that, does it? You have to go introduce something. You should do radio, too. You have a beautiful voice. So next year we'll be talking to you about your film.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too.
I'm working on it.
Yeah. So we have on our Facebook page, the Kathleen Dunn Show, information about the festival, but these films just sound spectacular, and you're having the time of your life,
oh,
I can tell.
Oh, yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having
me. Where are you going? Is it sold out?
Which one?
At 3 o'clock. Where are you going?
Evolution of a Criminal. It's not sold out. I'm getting
All
ready
right.
to go meet Darius. Introduce this film.
Okay, good. So it's not sold out. You can go to the Oriental Theater this afternoon. 3?
3 o'clock.
At 3. Just do it spontaneously.
Yeah.
Just go and see it. And,
just go and see
and
it.
And it'll
Matinee,
be a good thing. Yeah. Thank you very much for
Thank
being
you.
With us. Gerard Blanks, who's a 15-year veteran of the Milwaukee art and film scene. He's an up-and-coming filmmaker. Look for his name in lights in the not-too-distant future. And we're going to be speaking with one of the documentarians as we continue here. Black Lens is new this year and is an important part of the Milwaukee Film Festival. It's a program that showcases the work of established African-American filmmakers and also emerging filmmakers with a focus on the black community, and these films sound terrific. Don Perry, I told you that I had watched one of them last night, and it's really an interesting documentary about black photographers and the family, or considering what's happened to black families in this country, how difficult it's been to have a family, African-American family album. So we're going to be talking about that, about black photographers and the emergence of a people. The documentary is Through a Lens Darkly. The writer-executive producer will join us in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One of the films in the documentary series Black Lens, part of the Milwaukee Film Festival, is about, it's titled Through a Lens Darkly, and it's the family photo album of African-American families, how photos have been used for self-affirmation and also for degradation over the course of American history, and it's really fascinating. Don Perry, writer and executive producer of this documentary, is with us now. He's been with Chimpanzee Productions for a number of years, co-wrote and co-produced 12 Disciples of Nelson Mandela. He's worked on projects for HBO documentary films, and we're delighted to have him with us. Don, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Yeah. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It is amazing, as I watch this, how much history you were able to encapsulate looking at African-American photographers and the subject, the family subject, and the historical record. It was very moving. Must have been very moving to make this, because pictures tell us so much. And if you're really good at taking a picture, you're capturing a lot, more than the moment.
Yes, exactly. One of the people that we kind of give reference to is Leopold Senghoré, who was one of the Negritude poets from the mid-1960s. And he said that the photograph was the one sure thread that connected one person's eyes with another's heart.
Oh.
And that really informed a great deal of why we let the photographs be text and just to let people see another person's heart.
Mm-hmm. One of the big threats in the film is using the family photograph for self-affirmation. And I realized how incredibly important that was to the African-American family, considering all that that family had been through slavery times, through lynching times, through such horrors in American history. To have a picture of a stable, happy family was really an important thing to do at times in life.
It certainly was, but I think it's also important to understand that these documents were never really intended as a political statement. That's an interpretation that we bring to them, looking at them now in the absence of, or over the course of the last 170 plus years removed. At their moment of creation, those photographs were not dissimilar from the same things that people do today. We have a camera. We're in a family event, and someone feels the urge to take out that camera or take out that camera phone now and snap this moment because it resonates with them. It means something to them in that moment. And so what we're doing now through the course of the film, of course, is looking at these documents that were meant as heartfelt mementos of one person's love, either for their own family or to send something to a family member to say, remember me.
Right.
And to also remember, too, that the act of taking that photograph then was not so simple. I mean, under the technology at the time, it took at least an hour or two to make those photographs become photographs.
Mm-hmm. And some of those photographs, particularly the ones taken during Reconstruction time, the point was made that this was something that you had to pay a pretty penny for to have your picture taken, and yet it was an important thing to do, talk about how you were reconstituting the African-American family or letting the world know what the family looked like. It was a whole new creation.
It was, and I think it's very doubly important for American audiences now to see these images because these are the images that have been unfamiliar to us.
Yes.
If you were to look at a high school textbook today on the Reconstruction period, they would probably have one or two images, none of which would be the self-affirming, self-determining images that you see in this film of Black families standing proudly in front of the camera to say, look at me, this is who we are. This is something that we're creating to commemorate our coming back together again in many cases, having been separated by the travails of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not dissimilar, actually. When we premiered the film in Salt Lake City, a couple who had been relocated there from the Katrina area told us almost exactly the same kind of story that I'm sure that if we were a photographer in 1870, we would have heard. That their family had been scattered, and the very first thing they did when they were able to bring all the people back together again was go into a photo studio and have a family portrait taken.
And also the historical record that was taken, I was struck by the soldiers who were photographing themselves, the Black soldiers during the Civil War, and tell me what you think the statement was they were making, and also the soldiers who came back from World War I, and these photos make you cringe, in some cases were lynched in their World War I uniforms.
Yes, I mean, when people think of Black soldiers in the Civil War, the image that comes to mind is the movie Glory and Morgan Freeman, mm-hmm. and the Matthew Broderick. It's as if the only kind of representation of Black people is subservient to the dominant majority, when in reality, what you had in the Civil War particularly were 186,000 Black men serving in that war. And they were not all under the officer corps of a white lieutenant or a white general. They had their own officer corps, and that's represented in these images. And so I think it's a revelatory shock for people to see, my God, look at all these people. They don't look subservient. They don't look like they're waiting for someone.
Exactly.
In fact, we make a very good point of telling the story of Gordon. If there is a single iconic image that people everywhere, at least I hope everywhere, would recognize, it's the image of the former slave with the scarred back.
Yes.
And the way that image has been utilized is to show, oh, look at these poor Black people that, and the horrors that they've experienced under slavery. This is particularly poignant for use as abolitionists propaganda to say this is why this peculiar institution must be abolished. But the reality about that photograph and what we spend some time on in the film to give a context, not just for it, but also for all these photographs of Black Civil War soldiers, is the fact that Gordon was a hero, that he escaped from slavery, he went into the Union Army, and he liberated his own people. And it's not a picture depicting a victim. It is a picture of a man saying, yeah, look at me, look at what I've been through, and I am a hero. And he was called a typical Negro, which was, you know, unbelievable for that particular moment in time to say this is a typical Negro, and he is a hero.
Right.
Now, step forward, when we start talking about blacks serving their country to demonstrate that, yes, we helped to build this country. We have fought and shed blood to help make America free in all the foreign wars. We've been up there. We've been from the Civil War all the way on. We've been there. This is in contradiction to the way that black people have been depicted in the popular culture as somehow less than American, less than a full citizen, that somehow we have been kind of shoved to the side. When you look at these images, what you see is a people standing forward for the highest ideals of this country.
Yes.
And willing to sacrifice their blood for that.
Yes, very, very well said. The other thing that was striking to me is the picture, the moment that we had right at the beginning of Reconstruction, and the picture of African-American elected leaders who were all dressed and looked as though they were ready to lead us to good things, and how short a period of time that was. But what a refashioning, and what a statement of incredible strength and leadership some of those photos are.
And even more so, because they're so unfamiliar to us,
mm-hmm.
We talk about now universal pre-K. Elementary or pre-kindergarten. We talk about universal health care. We talk about universal education. All of those things were measures that had been introduced by those Congresses in the Reconstruction period by former slaves.
Goodness.
Because they understood the value of education. Having been denied it, they felt it was something that needed to be made available for everyone. They understood the value of health care, and they were passing what we would call progressive legislation during those post-Civil War period. But the other thing that happened then, and for those people who are ahistorical, it's important to remember, because if you don't remember the past, you're always going to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
But the election of 1876 that saw Benjamin Harrison go into the White House was the election that sealed the fate, if you will, of all of that progressive movement had taken place. And from that point forward, what we had was a reinstitution of white supremacy in the South. And in order to justify that supremacy, it was necessary to denigrate black people
mm-hmm.
once again. And that is what you, in terms of the war of images that is referenced in the film, that's what you see taking place. That in order to justify the inhumane treatment, to put black people back into their place, their rightful place in the eyes of the white supremacists, it was necessary to demean them, to stereotype them, to make other people, using the image as propaganda, to make other people look at them and say, not worthy.
Mm-hmm. And we see a lot of that. You make reference to D.W. Griffith's film Birth of a Nation. There it was, right? Let's make fun of African Americans.
Exactly, exactly. And that's that whole, you know, movement of using the image. And this is one of the things that we focus on in the film, the fact how the image has been utilized to create an impression about, quote, the other. One of the things that we talk about, not necessarily in the film directly, but what we like, you know, what we hope we've drawn a pretty clear line under, is the fact that when you look at these images, what you're seeing are human beings doing things that all human beings do, that we have these shared values and experiences as family, as people enjoying the company of their loved ones, that transcend any notion of race. And what was important in order to justify the peculiar institution was to create the impression that somehow these people, African Americans, were not human. So we start off with one of the earliest uses of photography to begin to justify the inhumane treatment of others by making them appear to be somewhat less than the dominant group.
Right. Yeah.
And what it underscores is the fact that race is a construction, and that by the time you get to the end of the film, it is a construction that no longer works for us as a culture. And it's time we grew up and grew beyond it.
We're talking with Don Perry, writer and executive producer of Through a Lens Darkly, which will be featured as part of the Black Lens element in the Milwaukee Film Festival, which is on right now, a whole list of all of the films, including when you can see this particular film, which is very worth seeing, is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can call the conversation if you want. You haven't seen the film yet, but you, certainly the subject of what we're talking about is worthy of your participation. So if you'd like to join us, please let me give you the phone number. If not, I understand. But here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. I want to talk as we continue about Frederick Douglass and the many portraits of him, Sojourner Truth, and the portraits that she had done of herself and why they did that, and also about Emmett Till. So that's coming up. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And before we go to a few phone calls, let's talk about Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth. There are many pictures of them, and they had a lot of pictures of their images distributed. Why?
During the 1850s, and Frederick Douglass was one of the earliest people to understand the power of the image to transform the way people would think of the black subject. And in one of his very, very early writings about it in his newspaper, The North Star, in 1848, he actually called upon African Americans to take up the camera for two reasons. First, because he saw it as a way of self-employment. I mean, there was a demand for this new technology, and people were flocking to camera studios wherever they were. You had a lot of entrepreneurial activity, and it was a very good way to become self-employed and to make your own way in the world. But the second thing was, he fully understood that in order to combat the way people viewed black folks at that moment in time, in the 1840s, 1850s, and into going into the Civil War, it was absolutely necessary for them to see images of black people, because up to that point, the only images that were available widely were stereotypical images that were painting a very false, untrue portrait of the black subject. So he personally used the camera technology in order to make images of himself throughout his life, becoming in the process the most photographed man of his generation, and using his image to show people, well, look, look at this image of this person, and this is at a time when most people were not literate, and they tended to use what they saw in a publication or a broadside or as an image as, you know, a stand-in for truth. And looking at his images, very formal portraits, would run counter to all these other things running around. And it was his intent to use that image to create a sense that, wow, maybe these other things are not accurate, and that look at this person.
Right.
This is a person worthy of respect. Now, Sojourner Truth, people may know of her various activities. I mean, she was really one of the first suffragettes for women's rights. But as an abolitionist, she used the image as well, and she was one of the first women to sell the shadow to support the substance. That was a line that she put on the bottom of all of her photographs. But the other thing about it was these were very carefully constructed images, because she also, like Douglass, understood that the images that people see become in their minds truth. And so showing herself as a woman of means, a woman of substance, a woman who has a trade. She was a seamstress, and shows some of the photographs of her are with the tools of that trade. They show her with books. Oh, she must be learned and educated, even though that wasn't the case. She was wearing glasses, even though she didn't need them. But they projected an aura of, oh, this is a person of substance. This is a person of learning. This is a person of means. And this is why they use those images in a very, very early on in the technology to put up a counter, to use themselves as a counter balance to the negativity that was more prolific.
Yeah. Oh, see what I mean about how fascinating this film is? All these elements are in the documentary Through a Lens Darkly. Let's go to Barb in Madison calling in. Hi, Barb.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I wanted to ask the guest if in the process of researching or making this movie, he had run across what I think is one with a parallel theme, which is there's a book and a movie by Jack Shaheen, and it's called Real Bad Arabs. That's R-E-E-L. If he had seen that or had any comment on that, and I guess the question is more broadly, does he feel that this experience is parallel by the experience of other racial or ethnic minorities in the U.S.?
Absolutely. African-Americans, I think, in some way, are a little bit like the canaries in the mine shaft. We've been there. We experience a lot of things, probably first, and we have a lot that we have contributed and that we contribute still to the making of the culture. And every place we've gone with Through a Lens Darkly, every film festival, it's been all over the world. And it's continuing now. My writing partner and director is en route to Rio de Janeiro right now, where it's going to be showing there. Everybody resonates with this story because the use of images to pigeonhole people, to create a representation that may not be the most accurate representation is something that every group has experienced. Nell Painter, who is one of the historians in our film, and she's an expert on the life and has written about the Sojourner Truth, has written a book that's entitled Whiteness, A History of Whiteness. And she talks in that book about the way that whiteness has been carefully and very calculatedly projected through a wide variety of material in the popular culture, of which images are one, and how at various points in the history and evolution of the society, whiteness has been enlarged to bring in and become more inclusive of certain groups. So, for instance, the most recent time has been the enlargement of whiteness in order to bring in the Eastern Europeans, the Irish, the Catholic, who weren't necessarily considered white, which is kind of strange in its own way. But what has not happened is that African Americans, Native Americans, Latino people have not been included in this definition of mm-hmm. whiteness mm-hmm. yet. And so that battle from the perspective of representation and validation still continues.
Thank you for the call. Reggie, can you say what you have to say in about 30 seconds, almost out of time?
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to say thank you. I appreciate that guy. I think he's doing a wonderful job. And also, he said something pertaining to, like, you know, they took it from, made black men seem like we haven't contributed to this country. But I also think, like, I have a problem with being called African-American. I really like to be called American. But I wanted to know, what did he think about that right there? Because I think I'm a full American.
All right. Don, we have about 30 seconds.
No, he's absolutely correct. We are Americans, and that comes through. We are Americans by by nature of the sacrifices and the contributions that we have made to build this country. And it's underscored when you look at the photographs of our lives here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Reggie, very much for your call. Well, it's really a good film. And I guess the mark of it is it's engaging. And I just never thought of some of the things that were in this film before, Don. And thank you for making it. It's really good.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And everyone come out to see it.
Absolutely. Don Perry. It's going to be in the Milwaukee Film Festival. And you should, well, there are so many good films to see, but you'll like this one. Film Festival 6th Annual runs through October 9. And Through a Lens Darkly screens this Thursday at the Fox Bay Cinema Grill and twice next week. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this show.